BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Hello and welcome to Dalek Radio for Saturday the 4th of July. This week we're here from the United States, where doubts are beginning to surface about some of the business connections of new President Barack Obama. Back here in Bristol, we hear from the head of news and current affairs at HTV, now ITV West, who departed at Christmas. What was James Garrett's most memorable story he covered after more than 15 years of journalism at their Armistice headquarters? I've got a bit of the sniffles, so I apologise if I'm a little bit nasally. How I've managed that in a heatwave, I'm not exactly sure, but I have. We have the latest instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Grieve, and coming in to tickle your musical taste buds, it's lead singer Andy Price from Bristol punky rock band Dig for Fire. All that and more interviews coming up. I'm John Peters Coleman. There have been big changes at ITV, with local non-news programming coming down over the last few years from about 7 hours to only half an hour a week. This is because, despite hard economic times, ITV companies still have to pay a multi-million pound licence fee to the government before they broadcast a single programme. As ITV News is cut to the bone, one of those to leave is local journalist and producer James Garrett, who is the head of news and current affairs at Bristol, based ITV West, until Christmas. Our Daleks Tony Gosman caught up with him last week and asked him about the most significant story he covered over nearly 15 years at Arnold's Vale.
I had the awful responsibility and incredible good fortune of making a programme, which went out both as an HTV West Eye View and also as a Channel 4 Dispatches, which led to the Bristol heart surgery scandal being stopped, and the three senior doctors who had been abusing the trust of their patients for so many years ending. And there had been, to my shame, I was aware of some articles, a couple of articles, been published in Private Eye in the early 90s, which suggested that there was a problem at Bristol. I didn't look into it. Somebody at the BBC did and made a programme which kind of told a bit of the story but didn't get to the heart of the matter, really. As a result, the anaesthetist who had been blowing the whistle within the health service for ages came to HTV, and because it looked like it was going to be a difficult story, it was given to me, and he and I built up a relationship over the next year, which resulted in this programme going out. And immediately the Dispatches programme had gone out on Channel 4, and the West Eye View had gone out on ITV. The General Medical Council announced it was setting up what at that stage was the biggest ever investigation into medical negligence, and it resulted in three doctors all being found guilty of serious professional misconduct, two of them being struck off the medical register, and the third never operating on children again. Now, I thought that was an amazing result, really, and that was, I suppose, that was what I went in television into journalism to do, was to change, have an impact on people's lives. And the impact I was not looking for particularly was to see people disgraced, but that was their problem, not mine. The impact was that the impact in Bristol was that children parents could with confidence take their children to be operated on, confident in the knowledge that that they would have at least as good a chance of surviving their surgery here as anywhere else, and that senior doctors could not get away again with telling patients and their parents one thing when actually the opposite was true. And I think that the wider benefit of that program is that it helps people to realize that doctors who had been, I think, sort of we kind of put on a pedestal, can suffer the same failings as the rest of us, and that when it's perfectly all right to say to a doctor, okay, so you tell me that my child is needs a surgery and it's risky stuff. So how good are you? And are you the best person to do that job in this hospital? And how does your hospital compare with the national average? I think the program helped start a process of empowering people to feel confident about asking, so are you good enough to do this operation on me or on my child? And if you're not, well, thanks for telling me that the operation's needed, but sounds like we need to go somewhere else to have that done. And I think that's a really powerful result of a program, which was incredibly difficult to make because, you know, it meant contacting people who had lost children and who clearly were never going to get over that, and discussing with them the possibility that perhaps their child need not have died. And that's obviously a really terrible thing for parents to come to terms with. So it was a very difficult program to make emotionally, but it was an incredibly important one to make, and I'm privileged to have been a part of the team that brought that scandal to light.
For those that don't know that much about the Bristol Babies Heart scandal, can you just describe what failings in the establishment that it exposed?
The failings in Bristol were so total that it's hard to believe that they had been allowed to carry on for so long. First of all, babies were being operated on by heart surgeons who weren't really sufficiently skilled to do the job. They were being operated on in facilities that were quite inappropriate. There was no specialist children's heart surgery facilities. The children and little babies were being operated on in adult facilities, and it wasn't until long after changes should have happened that that finally, you know, a dedicated children's heart surgeon came in and specialist facilities were provided, and now Bristol has as good as, if not a better, success rate for child heart surgery as anywhere else in the world. But at the time, in the early 90s, that was absolutely not the case, and it hadn't been the case for a very long time. And what really angered me as an individual, you know, whose two children had been born in Bristol, was that within the health service, everybody knew that heart surgery in Bristol on children was absolutely crap. And if you were a doctor and your child needed a heart surgery, you would go a long way from Bristol to have that operation done. But we, the general public, were not in on that. And I think that was one of the scandals, that, you know, it was well known within the health service that Bristol was rubbish. But, you know, individuals, members of the public, continue to take their children there, almost like lambs to the slaughter, really.
That was ex-head of news and current affairs at RTV West until last Christmas. James Garrett was talking to our Tony Gosling last week about a story he covered which made national news, the Bristol Babies Heart Scandal. And you can hear the whole of that interview, including James's early days in newspapers on the internet, if you search for the Bristol page of the National Union of Journalists Oral History Project.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'd like to welcome to the studio Janet Sheik and Ches Chesney, who are a landlord and landlady, who I understand you own properties in West Street, just off Old Market Street.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
Now, sex is quite a big industry in Bristol. Is it a good industry for the city, and how does this sort of relate to you and where you're living directly?
Well, first of all, it's something I suppose that I had never thought about. I, as a liberal woman, I suppose I've had a fairly live and let live attitude to the whole massage parlour, sex industry, lap dancing club thing. Really wasn't something that I spent any time thinking about until suddenly a shop that was beneath the flat that I rented out popped open as a brothel. And then I had no choice but to think about it. Having looked into it, we became very concerned at the lack of licensing, the lack of any sort of regulations or proper controls on brothels, massage parlours. And we found, along our journey, I suppose, we discovered that unlike sex shops, if you have a sex shop, then you have to pay £15,000 or more every year to have it licensed.
Okay. How did you come to think, I mean, obviously opening a sort of a brothel in such a blatant way would be illegal. How did you become aware that it was becoming a brothel and not just a massage parlour?
Well, Janet got a call from her tenant. He rang, he'd been there about 18 months, a very nice chap. He rang up and said, I'm leaving at the weekend.
The week before, he had said how much he loved it, he loved the flat, he loved the area, he loved the other people in the house.
Yeah.
Suddenly he was leaving. So off he went. And then we heard that the people that had been running the massage parlour known as The Exchange, who also owned the massage parlour across the road in West Street called the Adam and Eve, it was them that was opening a massage parlour. So of course we knew then that it was a brothel, that we were talking about prostitution.
Okay. And I mean, despite it obviously sort of being illegal to run a brothel, how did it directly affect the local area and the tenants?
Well, for a start, a shop that had been there beforehand was a shop that had opened from 9 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Suddenly, you've got a massage parlour there, which is a 24-hour-a-day concern. And rush hour for a massage parlour is when the clubs close at 2 o'clock in the morning, so 2 till 4 in the morning becomes rush hour. Of course, you have all sorts of unsavoury people arriving. There is a huge drug issue with the prostitution situation. So it was transformed that place from somewhere that was safe and pleasant. For example, there was only one front door, so anyone going into the flats would be seen to be going into the massage parlour.
I see.
The lights, the electrics, the meters were downstairs in the dungeon or basement or whatever you want to call it of the massage parlour. So, huge impact.
Okay.
And very much in your face.
So would you be happy enough if they basically just moved their brothel just somewhere else? Would that just sort of make you think, well, they're not exactly where I'm, not where I am, not in my backyard, so...
I think once you've looked at it and really thought about what really goes on in massage parlours, you see, as a fairly liberal woman, it's easy to have the notion of sex industry as a sort of Dolly Parton type setup where there's some sisterhood going on in there, all girls together turning tricks for judges. And it just isn't like that. These are desperate women who I'm sure would much prefer my life to the life that they are forced to endure. We marginalise those women.
Have you seen these? Have you met these women? Have you seen them?
I've read their testimonies.
I met one. I met a girl who was
coming out of the exchange.
Was coming out of the exchange. She was looking for her property.
Yeah. And she was clearly off her face on something.
She was clearly drugged.
Yeah.
So you think that she was drugged by somebody else? Or
no, but I think that is a very easy way of controlling a woman, isn't it? If suddenly she has a heroin addiction or a crack habit, you're going to need the money. What are you going to do to get the money? What do you perceive your choices to be? Women in prostitution very often have been women who have been through the care system or the don't care system, as it might be more accurately labelled, where perhaps they've already been abused. I think there's a whole lot of very complex reasons as to why women find themselves working in brothels, and we certainly aren't out to further marginalise them or damage them in any way. One of the problems that has broken my heart on this journey is understanding that people aren't out there helping these women out of their lives in prostitution. There is some wonderful work being done by 125 who deal with streetwalkers.
Yes.
But brothels are perceived to be something out of sight, out of mind. The reality is they're violent places where women are being exploited and objectified every day.
Are women forced to work there?
Who knows? The problem is you don't know, and neither do I, because it's nobody's job to go into those places and find out. Occasionally a policeman might put his head around the door, but he's in uniform. What are you going to say as a woman that works there? What are you going to say when somebody says, is this your choice? Are you happy to work here? What are you going to say to the policeman that's there? If they were licensed and regulated in some way, or simply not tolerated, that might have been safer for all concerned.
So brothels are sort of crossing a certain moral line with you, but there's already what you might term sex establishments already. There's a lap dancing club. Is that okay?
No, it isn't okay. Certainly lap dancing clubs are a huge risk in that they seem to be thought of by the wider society as fun or harmless, which is what makes them so very dangerous. Men, for goodness sake, men that are about to marry a woman tomorrow seem to go with their friends to lap dancing clubs and think that it's okay. No, it isn't okay. Those women have to pay to work there. If you work in Stringfellows, a woman has to pay £15 at the beginning of the shift and £65 at the end of the shift. These, again, are places where women are exploited and harmed, objectified, told how to package themselves, because the punters don't want to see these women as their sisters or their daughters or their wives. They are required to portray themselves as sex objects, as someone purely there that can be bought and paid for to dance in your lap or gyrate on you or thrust their breasts in your face. That is very clearly sex establishment, sex encounter establishment, and yet at the moment, again, they are licensed at the moment in the same way as a cafe bar or a cinema or a theatre.
Yeah. Are you lone voices in West Street, not Market Street, in terms of or disapproval of these establishments?
We held a meeting about this. Chairs might like to...
Yeah, we had... Our first meeting was with the traders in the street, and around 35 people turned up, which was a pretty good turnout, and there was a general consensus that the people in the street really didn't like the reputation it had.
They felt that the brothels were bad for business.
Okay.
Yeah, and they voted to form an old market community association. One of the aims of that association is to stop the proliferation of the sex industry in Old Market. In recent years, the population of Old Market has more than doubled and is continuing to do so. There's been a huge influx of new flats very nearby. And yet still, we don't have greengrocers, we don't have a chemist, we don't have anywhere to buy. We do have one shop that you can buy a pint of milk in Old Market Street.
Yeah, so what can you do about it? I'm leaving. What have you tried to do?
And
what
can you try to do? We can appeal to the council to stop giving planning consent for shops, retail shops, as bars, clubs, nightclubs. We don't need any more bars and nightclubs. We need daytime use. Old Market really is pretty dead during the day. If you go along at 2 o'clock at night, it might be humming. But during the day, there is none of the amenities that reasonable, decent people require to live in their neighbourhood.
So, I mean, you're only just around the corner from Trinity Police Station. Why don't the police simply close the brothel down? It's illegal, sort of fairly clear, isn't it?
Well, the problem there is... There are a number of problems. First of all, the police focus on streetwalkers. They've told us on a number of occasions that they don't focus on the massage parlours, because it's not on the streets, because it's behind closed doors.
Chez offered to start an internet crack and heroin business in order to clean up the streets. We wondered whether that would gain police support.
Because that's the way they act about brothels. If it's not falling out onto the street, they don't really consider it as an issue.
Right.
They have this attitude. Well, many of the policemen we've spoken to consider that brothels are licensed, which is completely untrue.
We've heard them say that. It's better for it to take place in properly licensed establishments. There's huge misunderstanding. But fundamentally, you tell me, it's an illegal business if one man owns several brothels across the city, and you know who he is, and you know what he's doing. Explain, what is the problem? Why is it allowed? Why are the police choosing which laws to enforce and so which ones to turn a blind eye to?
You feel there's an unwritten consensus that, you know, this should be left to continue for reasons that
yes.
you understand.
I think that the police find it much harder work to collect the evidence against the criminality in the brothels. It's actually not illegal for a prostitute to do her work, as it were. What's illegal is for other people to gain from the work of a prostitute. And that's what the men who inevitably are running these places are doing. They're breaking the law.
So what about Bristol Council? I mean, they're the people that would also ultimately could make a big difference in this.
Bristol City Council has the opportunity, and they took it in our case, to prevent a change of use of, say, a retail outlet into what's called sui generis, which is a sort of general umbrella, a general name for a business that isn't retail, some
yeah.
other kind of business.
Like tattooing or...
Hairdressing, I think, yeah. comes under that type. So they have the opportunity to prevent that by saying, no, we don't want that kind of change of use.
Yeah.
And that's what they've done in our case.
Okay. There are local campaigns such as Objects and Bristol Fawcett and the 125 Project. I mean, has your association that you formed had any interactions with these? Are you sort of grouping together?
Yeah, well, I've joined up with Fawcett, so I'm certainly gaining a lot of knowledge and support from them. They've been very good. I've met up with 125. I've spoken with some of the women that run it. So yes, I think the answer is yes, I'm in touch with them.
Okay, so what do you see to be in the future? Do you think you're going to be successful in reversing the fortunes of the Old Market Street area?
Yeah, I'd just like to say that it has made a difference to Bristol City Council. I've seen emails where they have said, we are now considering Old Market in a new light.
I'd like to see a situation where more people are going to wake up and recognise the problems from the licensing laws as they stand at the moment. They're not being properly licensed or regulated. Very often lap dancing clubs are fronts for prostitution. That happens all over the country. It's well documented. It isn't something that should simply be allowed to proliferate at its current rate. The number of lap dancing clubs has doubled since this change in licensing in 2003.
Right.
And more lap dancing clubs are opening every week. So it really is coming to you very soon.
Come to us very soon, and time to do something about it. Thank you very much for you coming in.
And
it's,
thank you.
Been
thank
great
you
to
for
the story.
Us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Ah, it's time for a representative from the band of Dig for Fire to take his place in front of the microphone. I've got Andy Price with me here. Dig for Fire are a sort of alternative punk, and they write all their own material and record it. Play us a tune. What would you like to play us? Give us a flavour.
I'll do one off our second record. It's called Make My Day.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
banana trees. I'm speaking with ease from the rooftop, fed on the Paris canteen. Life's ahead of state, another reprobate, trying to masturbate over decisions that don't affect us at all. Whoa. But it's like you and me, without a purpose, maybe. Can you honestly say you pay your way? When the sun sets at the end of the day, can you honestly say that you made anyone's day? Because you're working hard, but there's no money in your pocket, and you're getting shot away. Eyeballs hanging out the sockets, now you're coming round. The lost and found, just keep your head close to the ground. But it's no use, you're almost dead. You pass out drunk, half on the bed. You make it up, you go along, but everyone's singing the same song. But it's like you and me, without a purpose maybe. Can you honestly say you pay your way? When the sun sets at the end of the day, can you honestly say that you made anyone's day? Because these banana trees are speaking with these from the rooftops that only the Paris can see. Lies ahead of state, another reprobate, trying to masticate over decisions that don't affect us at all. Whoa. But it's like you and me, without a purpose maybe. Can you honestly say you pay your way? When the sun sets at the end of the day, can you honestly say that you made anyone's day?
Surely far more muted applause than he deserves, but there's not many of us here, you see, so the applause will be much more. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for coming in.
No worries.
As I noticed, and as has been noted, you know, I've got written here that you're into sort of punky rock. You look very well coiffured and trimmed for a...
I did just have a shower before I got here. It's been a very hot day.
Okay. How long have you been going?
2 years. 2 years. We started... couple of Novembers ago, I believe.
It's a very nice guitar. Tell me very, very briefly just a little bit about your guitar. It's very nice.
This guitar I bought from a company based in Bath called Lindo. It's half depth, so it's good for gigging, nice and light. Yeah. And I ordered it, they do a mail order thing, didn't come, so I got to go visit their workshop because I had to exchange it because they sent me the wrong one, which was quite nice because I work in Bath. So I just walked up the hill over lunchtime, picked up.
Cool. How long have you been playing guitar?
Since I was about 14, about 10 years. I've never really been ambitious.
Okay. I'm going to ask you the Jules Holland question, because you always ask this, but you do get some interesting answers. What was your very first memories of music that got you excited?
I remember listening to the Red Hot Chili Peppers, their earlier stuff with all the slap bass. Because I started playing bass before guitar, and I thought, oh, I'll get a bass guitar, I'll do that.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks, I'll be able to do all that stuff that the guy from the Chili Peppers is doing, but I was wrong. And I figured that you can get away with playing just chords, rhythm guitar, with a normal guitar, so that's when I moved on to that.
Okay, fair play. You've already done one album for Dick and Fire. You've made two.
Yeah,
you've already made one. You've just done your second.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find the transition from playing stuff live to actually trying to get your sound onto an album? The production side of things.
It's interesting because we've done it all ourselves. It's been quite interesting. We don't know any studio tricks. On our first album, we used two microphones for the drums, which is just silly, but it worked out all right in the end. Our second album, we recorded. Drums quite cheap in a studio and did the rest ourselves, but essentially it's just whatever we do live we just play again.
Okay, so quite a raw sound.
Yeah, lo-fi and raw, and it's just a way of getting stuff out quicker, sooner rather than later, so you don't waste months on trying to produce it or anything. Just we were doing gigs and we just felt, why go around playing gigs if we've got nothing that people can take home with them.
Okay, how do you find the trying to get gigs and local music scene?
We don't find it too tricky to get gigs because our drummer used to do tour promotion
for my old band as well, so he's got quite a few good contacts.
Nice.
So out of town is usually alright. We've mainly been playing the south of the country. We're hoping to go to Manchester and Liverpool and stuff later on in the year, but Bristol's fairly simple as well, because he does promotions at the Croft. We're quite good friends with Bob at the Junction, so we do a lot of our own gigs there.
Okay. What is your big vision, your big dream? National punk rock fame?
Not quite. Maybe when we were 17 or 18 and we first started playing in bands, but we got a bit older and a bit wiser and realised that we weren't going to be the next huge band. Now it's just more about doing something interesting, doing something different. Because we're completely independent, it's a lot easier for us to just put stuff out for free, put stuff out ourselves, because we haven't got the goal of making any money. You know, we've all got a day job. If we lose a bit of money travelling somewhere here and there, it doesn't matter. As long as we get to go somewhere, do something different, meet people, that's good by us.
Okay, so fairly low-key. I mean, what do you think of the music industry as a whole, then? Has that kind of put you off at all? Has that kind of...
Not really, because I do quite a lot of music stuff anyway. I write for magazines as my day job. I do a lot of music journalism, so I kind of work for the bigger magazines, something like Total Guitar I do reviews for, but then a friend of mine does a purely independent music magazine as well, which he prints himself, really good quality, and that's got him quite far, and we do a lot of stuff with that, so I see more the way the music industry is going than the way it is at the moment, and it's more kind of the stuff we're doing. Whether it'll ever make any money out of it is another thing, but we're kind of going the way.
So more generally, I mean, CD sales have been falling year on year since the millennium. Everybody's kind of saying the music industry is going to pieces, it's all going to pot. Where is it going?
Well, CDs, I don't understand why labels are still holding on to them, to be honest. The thing about major labels is they've always been about 10 steps behind everyone else, and they just continue to do so. They're still kind of holding on. Even MP3s, that's not going to be the source of income. The recordings, selling the recordings, is not going to be the source of income in the future. It'll be sponsorship deals and gigs, revenue, merchandise like that. More people are going to see bands now. Concerts is the big money making, but you know, 10 years ago the major labels completely flaked out on MP3s and they've lost loads of money because they're only started getting into it now. If they don't do something about kind of gigs and live shows, then they're going to lose out again and they're going to die off, but then that's a good thing. It's the independent labels who are doing the interesting stuff.
Absolutely. Well, there you go. There's Dignified Starts in a nutshell, I think. Pretty excellent. Oh, play us another tune, please.
Okay. This is a brand new one, actually, so we've only been doing the last couple of practices, but I thought I'd bring it out today because we're working on recording new stuff soon.
Oh, just before we start, actually, I was going to say, how can people find out about Dignified? You got MySpace or?
Yeah, sure. We our MySpace is myspace.com/Dignified Music. We're on Last.fm as well. You can listen to a lot of our songs on there, and also just give us a shout through the MySpace, and we can sort you out the CDs and stuff.
Are you gigging in Bristol soon?
We are 29th of July at the Croft with Phlegm, Bullwhip, and Oxygen Feet, who's a good friend of ours, so be good fun.
I've had 24 years to think this life over. I've had 24 years to think this life over, and I found that I found that I don't really give a damn. I've had 24 years to free fall with self-destruction. I've had 24 years to free fall with self-destruction, but I still never caught up with you. Because these are the pitfalls, the ones inside your head, the ones that you listen to when you're lying in your bed, letting go of the thoughts that are haunting your head. I've had 24 years to decide just what to do. I've had decisions made for me and decisions made by you. The conclusion that I keep is that I let myself get hurt. And I've had 24 years to decide just what to do. But each and I turn right back into my right room. Why you these 24 years deciding what to do? Because these are the pitfalls, the ones inside your head, the ones that you listen to when you're lying in your bed. It's so much harder to deal with when you catch you them all down.
listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
After 5 months in power, one question keeps being asked of US President Barack Obama, namely, is he delivering his promised changes? The bailout seems only to have put off the dollar crisis until an unspecified future date, and may even have made things worse by further depleting the government's coffers. War in Iraq, Pakistan and Afghanistan still rumbles on with few signs of retreat and peace. Illegal jails are still not closed down. Threats to Iran continue as well, only the emphasis has changed. US journalist and historian Webster Tarpley believes there is a reason for this, and begins by pointing out that US presidents have been puppets since the 1960s, the Kennedy era.
Obama has been groomed over a long period of time. I think the idea is to prevent others from seizing the presidency and to make sure that there was a pliable puppet in the White House at this point to do precisely what the financiers wanted and not be pulled in other directions by all of those other interest groups. I would say over a period of time, people like Brzezinski, David Rockefeller, the Trilateral Commission, and these are all simply organizations of Wall Street bankers under different names, they groom politicians so that when a crisis arrives, they have a number of politicians ready to go that they can put into action. And Obama's one of these. In other words, it's not like they chose Obama 25 years ago to be president, but he was part of a larger group among whom they thought that they might eventually choose a president. I think democracy right now is in a grave crisis. Let me just also point out, Obama did not get a landslide at all. He got 52% of the vote. He's largely a beneficiary of the hatred of George Bush the Younger, which in many ways is understandable. But it doesn't mean that there's a great popular mandate for Obama to do anything. The problem is now the cynical manipulation, and it starts, of course, with the U.S. media. People wondered, why did the media hate Hillary Clinton, and why did they choose Obama? And I think the main explanation is all of those media are owned by Wall Street. And Obama is simply the unity candidate of the entire financier elite of the top U.S. money center banks. With Bush, you had a brutal, open imperialist. And his brutality was expressed in very frank terms. He'd say, bring it on, or dead or alive. But Obama, it's very different. Obama operates with deception, with trickery, with dissembling, with mass duping of the population. You can even call it mass brainwashing. The other difference is that with the neocons had the elementary cunning of a bully, which was to pick on states that were largely defenseless, like Iraq or Afghanistan. Very, very limited ability to strike back. When you get now to the Obama group, I would say this group is more adventurous, more insane strategically, and also better able to conceal what they're actually doing. The idea now is a kind of imperialism that plays other countries one against the other, while the U.S. remains, they think, unengaged. And I think that's the danger you see with proxies like Georgia or Poland or others. And now the question of Iran. And what is the project of Iran? If you look at Obama's speech in Cairo, it seems to me that the goal of Obama's Cairo speech is to play the Arab and Islamic world against China, cutting off Chinese oil, cutting off access to raw materials, and indeed against Russia, right? Some idea of some conflict between Iran and Russia that might eventually emerge. I would invite Obama to do the following. If you want to reset the relation, make a public announcement that there will be no Polish missile crisis, that there will be no ABM missiles installed in Poland, and indeed that there will be no NATO expansion to Ukraine and Georgia. This is very simple. What is the point of this relentless, provocative pushing of NATO right up to the doorstep and into the front yard and then into the living room? It makes absolutely no sense. I argue that the derivatives are the cause of the current depression and breakdown crisis. It's an interesting point, right? You ask the average person, why should there be a depression? What is causing the depression? You get maybe no answer at all or something crazy. The big difference between the world economy, say, in 1982, the Latin American debt crisis, or 1998 even, when you had the Asian contagion and long-term capital management blew up. The difference now is that we have a derivatives bubble which amounts, according to my estimate, to $1.5 quadrillion of derivatives in notional value. That means $1,500 trillion of derivatives worldwide, with maybe two-thirds of that in the United States, or between the United States and Great Britain. And these are paper based on paper. They're an extra level of exotic and toxic investment paper. There are the credit default swaps, the collateralized debt obligations, the structured investment vehicles, the asset-backed securities. So it's all some kind of security built on top of some other kind of paper security. And this poses the problem. If you have 1.5 quadrillion of derivatives, what can you do about that? And the answer is virtually nothing. It is a black hole. First of all, the U.S. is on the very, very wrong track, and we're only about a year, actually less than a year, into the really bad phase of the crisis. If you go back to the 1930s, you'll see that the fall to the bottom of the Depression took about 4 years. So I think we've got big events ahead of us. We've got, first of all, some kind of a dollar crisis is definitely in the cards, because Obama's putting out $13 trillion for the banks at the same time that Detroit and the auto industry is being destroyed, basically, and all kinds of productive activity is shrinking. So it looks like we're headed towards something like dollar hyperinflation. It may be even worse than hyperinflation. So we may be getting into, you know, huge, huge devaluations of the dollar, and that would then lead to probably to some kind of final crisis of the U.S. and British banking system. The dollar overhang is a big, big problem. $4 trillion out there in the world. I think what people ought to think about doing with those dollars is buy something with them. In other words, use them for something worthwhile. It would be very desirable to have some kind of a cooperative effort that would involve repatriating those dollars, not by dumping them, but by buying things. In other words, let the U.S. produce something for export that somebody wants to buy. And I think with that, you could maybe produce your way out of the crisis. And that really is the only way. I think the idea of sacrifice is simply monstrous. If we start with a depleted, exhausted population here, with the living standard having declined by about two-thirds, over the last 40 years. One of the things people notice about the U.S. is that the hours of work are far more than, say, in Europe. If you want to impose more austerity and sacrifice and cuts on that population, I think that's absolutely irresponsible. I think what we can expect here in the United States is a continuous deterioration of the economic situation for several years to come, and it can become extremely dramatic and extremely urgent to find a way out. The Republican Party has shown its bankruptcy with Bush. They continue to show their bankruptcy with these idiotic slogans about free markets and individual responsibility. What good does it do to talk about individual responsibility when the world is being crushed under 1.5 quadrillion of toxic derivatives? That makes no sense at all. I would hope that somebody in the Democratic Party is calculating right now that Obama is on his way to cratering. He's already begun to fall, right? He's lost 5% approval just in the last 2 months. So I think he has peaked, and he's now on the downward track. If we could get a left-wing or New Deal challenge against Obama coming out of the Democratic Party, that, I think, would at least give us the basis for something more constructive than we have now. But we've got the rest of this year, I think, is going to be very, very ugly and very difficult in this country.
That was Webster Tarpley talking about US President Barack Obama's alleged Wall Street puppeteers. And you can hear more from Webster Tarpley every week on World Crisis Radio at gcnlive, one word, .com. And you'll find a link to that on the Dialect website, which is dialectradio.co.uk.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
It's now time for another episode of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Grieve. It was written by John Fothergill. In the 1920s, he decided to become a landlord. He moved to Thame in Oxfordshire and started running the Spread Eagle Inn. But the people and customers he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Sir XY's secretary for all his art affairs came with his sister and son in a solid silver Rolls Royce with gold fittings to lunch. After lunch, he asked that his sister, who had come with oil paints, could take a note of my pink in the drawing room upstairs. Norman Wilkinson had told him about it, to carry out in Sir XY's new house. Now, if Sir XY had come himself, I might have been delighted. But as it is, he's getting something for nothing, which is not correct, and worse still, without knowing it. It would have been better had these people gone in and stolen their colour notes. My objection to this business is, perhaps, hypersensitive, but it smacked of a popular notion that a public house is a public place, for which the owner pays a heavy licence in order to have the privilege of being a philanthropist to all and sundry, without acknowledgement. In other words, they wouldn't have done this to a private house. Mrs. Greifenhagen said that in 15 years' time our sons would be able to take over the hotel. It rather shocked me at first. Why should it? True, the publican has to deal with all sorts, but so does the doctor and the businessman. And there never was a more interesting or stimulating trade. You get people at their best and out for the best. Not like a doctor's or lawyer's or a grocer's clients, for who would go to these willingly? But here is the only objection. It is a perpetual grindstone. There's no time for contemplation of your job, and little enough time to enjoy your patience. Moreover, I think that an hotel is a job to retire to, as ex-boxers do, or to take up at any rate when you have had a good time and learned what is good in people, their houses and food. The born-and-bred hotel keeper must necessarily be inexperienced. Ernest Thesiger turned up for the first time, and when I asked him why he'd come, he said it was so long since he'd been in a lunatic asylum. He told Ian Strang, who I had asked to do a series of etchings here, that he saw me run excitedly into the kitchen and say, "Mr. Thesiger is here to dinner. Open quickly a box of sardines." Capitalism. I told T, anti-capitalist, that when I first started business, I thought the other wine merchants were charging too much, and now that I knew the risks and costs of things, I was getting less certain about it. For instance, I found the other day 24 bottles of good wine in a broken heap on a collapsed shelf, and the worst of it was that the customer had to pay for those bottles. "Then," said T, with his little eyes bright, "I don't think much of your risks if the customer has to pay for them." "But," I explained, "if he didn't pay for the risks as well as the costs and overhead charges, license and everything else, I couldn't afford to be a wine merchant, nor could anyone else. In short, I don't stock wine for myself, but for the public. As a wine merchant, I'm simply his servant. And the fact that the public has to pay £1 for a thing everywhere else when I think I can sell it for 15 shillings is beginning to make me feel that I may be giving my capital and services too cheaply." "Then at last you have identified yourself with the trade," he said, implying, as I found out, that I was in a combination to fleece him. To which I replied that I was not certain of anything, but that business had at least taught me caution before condemning coal owners and everyone else. I told him about staff, how lovable ours was, but how hard it had been to teach some of them and keep them up to it, so that they might profit themselves and the town long before we were enriched. With no business experience, this utopian fellow yet persisted in the real argument and reason at the back of the general strike. H.G. Wells had been reading T's latest book, and I asked him if it was good. He said that there was one joke in it, which made it worth the 7 shillings and 6 pence. It was the counsel of a friend to a feeble man who declined to allow his wife to go and get a child elsewhere. "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his wife for his friends." It was my joke, which I had told to T some years before. An elderly gent was dining with a young man, in a little room where each table is inclined to overhear the other. He graciously told me that I had a very good wine list, but questioned my brandies being 1865. I told him that it was a mere silly name, and that it didn't take me in either, but he said he'd try it, and that he knew all about wine. When I asked him how he liked it, he said, "Frankly, I don't." It happens to be a good brandy, and everyone in the room heard this expert's opinion, which was embarrassing. Then he went on to say that he had noticed I had no Chateau Burgundy, so I had to tell the expert that there was no such thing as Chateau Burgundy. But what about Chateau d'Yquem? I replied, Yquem is not a Burgundy. As I was leaving the room, he said in an undertone to his young friend, But there are Chateau Burgundies. When I rudely interrupted, I tell you definitely that there are not. The next evening, in the same little dining room, a very rich and good-hearted American had been brought to dinner by two nice people. He sent for me, and told me my claret had neither a bouquet, nor a taste, nor a colour. To which pronouncement, five people in the room had to listen. This wine being one of my lesser favourites, I was rather shocked. Annie's bottle was in perfect condition. I gave him a bottle of fat Burgundy instead. Later I saw him spending a long time with Katie over the bill, so I went up to see what was the matter. Mr. Frothergill, what is 10% on £1.11 and 6p? Not bad, for a big businessman. Before going he insisted on a liqueur all round and said he'd come again 7,000 miles to dine here. After all, 7,000 miles is only like across the road to this sort of American, who is exactly like, in his good heart, figure and rather brutal ways, the Lancashire man. But with money added.
Well, that was a little blast from the past from the 1920s, courtesy of John Fothergill's diary, an innkeeper's diary, read by Malcolm Grieve.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Time to hand over to Jess Barks for the What's On Guide.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, July the 10th, the 45s will be performing with support from Rita Lynch at the Thunderbolt in Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and entry is free. Also on 10th of July, Flash Guns will be performing with support from The Colours at Moles Club in Bath. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £4 for members and concessions and £6 for guests. On to the song of the week, and I feature Nazareth. This group formed in Scotland in 1968 and are still around these days recording albums and touring. This is the track Razamanaz from the album Razamanaz.
We're gonna rise from the ashes.
Razz of Nazareth with the song Razzmanazz from the album Razzmanazz, which was released in 1973. For more information, you can check out www.nazarethdirect.co.uk. Moving on to Saturday, 11th of July, and the Atomic Rays will be performing their 50th gig at the Prom Bar in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Also on the 11th of July, Left Side Brain will be performing at the Louisiana in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance. Finally, on Sunday, 12th of July, The Defiled, The Morning After, Clockwork Sniper and Quarterblind will all be performing at the Beer Keller in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Well, that's all for this week's show. Dialect is a community internet radio station broadcast on BTFM on 93.2 FM and across the city of Bristol at 9 p.m. every Saturday and repeated at 6 every Sunday evening. You can find us on the web at dialectradio.co.uk and at bcfm.org.uk. Apologies once again for my slightly snivelly voice. I managed to get a cold in the middle of a heatwave. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to, either in reporting or on the engineering side, or just come and see what we do, do please get in touch by volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Thanks to our studio guests Janik Sheet and Chez Chesney, and also from Mr. Price, Mr. Andy Price from Dig for Fire. Check out myspace.com/digforfiremusic, and a reminder of the playing on the Croft on the 29th of July. Reporters this week were Tony Gosling, studio production this week was by Vinny Stritch-Curran, and thank you to Jeff Sparks as ever for his Watson guide. The producer was Tony Gosling. My name is John Peters Coleman, and this was Dialect Radio. Take care of yourselves, from all of us here in Queen Square. Have a very nice summery week.
Again, thanks to Glenn at CascadiaPublicRadio.org, who not only serves up Media Monarchy and the Corbett Report and Ground Zero Lounge and Alan Watt, Wayne Madsen, Webster Tarpley, on and on and on and on. Actually, if you just subscribe to Glenn's feed on RadioForAll.net, that'll pretty much cover you for all your alternative radio news needs.